Giles Brown.
Let's talk.
In his mid-20s, restless in the routine of city life, Louis D. Hall found himself wondering how to create the life he wanted to lead. It led to a fascinating series of adventures, covered in a great new book called In Green. Delighted to say that I'm joined live on the line by Louis D. Hall himself. Louis, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
The pleasure's all mine. Tell me a little bit about yourself, then. What you've been up to before you took off on this particular journey?
This one was at the time I was working in stables in Hyde Park, and I was working as an actor. Well, out of work actor for most of the time.
Right.
And then previous to that job, I actually left university, and then obviously COVID, we all remember that happened. And a friend of mine and many died of cystic fibrosis, and I wanted to do something to commemorate him because he was quite an outgoing guy. And I decided to I worked at a lettuce farm and then hired a pony to go down the UK, a Highland pony, and raise some money for the Cystic Fibrosis Trust. And then that journey, it was kind of intoxicating, the way it connected people, brought people together, and I mean, it was a lot of fun. And then I thought, well, I've got to do this again somehow, somewhere. Anyway, fast forward a couple of years later, working in the stables, not getting many jobs through the auditions, and I get a bit restless, as you said, and read this book, or came across this book called Don Quixote, which I'm sure many people have heard of, and that kind of inspired me, and I started creating this idea for a bigger journey across Europe.
Yeah, because I mean, obviously, tilting at windmills and all that across La Mancha. I mean, we're based with Spain's largest English language station, so many of us will be familiar with Cervantes' masterpiece. I mean, it's all very, very romantic and all that, but the harsh realities of plotting this route. I use my words advisedly. I sauntered down through the UK with a Highland pony, not a Shetland pony, a Highland pony. Must be somewhat different from the huge, from the end of the known world, as it was known, through to Italy, no?
Yeah, it's a different beast, really. I think the UK has its own challenges through. I mean, Scotland isn't really the easiest place to travel with a horse, with the bogs and the sinkholes. However, that's just a limited area. With Europe, it was, we were going through three different seasons. We were going through three different mountain ranges, and it's each one has their own particular difficulties. For example, we started in Tuscany and went west, and going up the Via Francigena, which was calm enough, and suddenly we got to the Ligurian Alps, and I genuinely didn't really know how I was going to cross these Alps. And it was also April, and you might ask, why would you do this in April? Quite a stupid time to do it. But I didn't want to get to Spain in the scourge of the summer.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to get across before it got too hot. But April, the Ligurian Alps was very difficult. We had wolves were on the rise because of the lack of people walking due to the pandemic. We had snow. Obviously, you're very remote, and all these caused their own difficulties. But taking it slow, taking it step by step, and learning as we go, learning as I go with my horse, Sasha.
Yes.
Yeah, and we kind of learned as we went, and then suddenly you build up all these skills and little weird tricks as you go, and you become stronger, I guess, with each day.
Now, just tell me a little bit about the couple of things that I haven't sort of clarified with you before as well. It's this, I mean, and we talked about the ride through Scotland, the ride down through Scotland, and you created, what was it? Is it the Big Hoof, isn't it? That's the charity that you created.
Exactly, that came on the back of that, the Big Hoof, yeah.
And also, this wasn't, and here comes an awful horse riding pun, this isn't your first rodeo. I mean, there's something about the Mongolians? I mean, just explain a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, so I grew up in Scotland in a kind of, a little farm. We had these two pretty grumpy-looking ponies that belonged to my sister and my mum, and I didn't really have much interest in it. I didn't really know horses in the UK, at least at that point in my life, from what I understood, were for people, certain sections of society, or just for recreation, and I just didn't really have any interest in it. When I was 18, left school, earned some money, and then me and two friends decided to go to northern Mongolia to find this tribe called the Zatan tribe.
As you do at 18. I mean, I was more forgetting a PSD and maybe going to see, going to see Tears for Fears in concert, but each to his own, yeah?
Yeah, fair enough. Anyway, we went, got, yeah, earned some money, got the flights, got there to find this tribe. And when we, to reach this tribe, we had to basically get there by using local ponies, the Mongolian ponies. And then suddenly through that journey, it was an absolute disaster. By day five, the ponies got stolen by a local farmer, and then we got them back, and then we went on the other side of the lake and got lost, and ended up actually finding the tribe, though, by chance. And we lived with them for 2 weeks. We fished with them. They sort of taught us the ways of the reindeer and the ponies. And suddenly my whole idea or construct of what horses and ponies are in the West was completely changed. And that really formed the idea of doing a long journey with a pony, like as a companion, you know, as opposed to just using it. And that kind of installed a seed for it for the rest of it.
Because if you think about it, we do have this 21st century, this 20th century, look at how we were, you know, we've regarded horses or anything as sort of pack animals, haven't we, rather than actually an intrinsic part of what it means to be living in the wild. And no more so than the Mongolians, or like you go back to the Scythians, you know, who were these wild men of and women of the steppes, who, you know, the Romans couldn't get a handle on them because they couldn't believe that people could live in such harmony with nature.
Absolutely. And then also, you know, parallel to that, the whole expansion of China was due to the fact that these heavenly horses lived in the Fergana Valley on the west of beyond these Chinese borders, and the Huns were masterful at, you know, trying, you know, destroying the Chinese. And this horse or being able to live in harmony with horses is this thing that kind of developed the modern world.
Yeah.
And anyway, yeah, as you say, it's something that's beyond our recognition, especially since 1910 onwards, when in the UK especially the motor replaced the horse. But I think one of the places that did inspire me a lot was actually Andalusia, because I spent a lot of time there working and for 6-7 months, and the horsemanship down there is pretty different to the UK, and it definitely had a sense of a much more kind of cohabiting space than, you know, having in the UK. Just you have your horse in a box or whatever in a field and go around in circles for eternity, which is quite depressing.
Yeah. What part of Andalusia, because I'm sitting in Andalusia at the moment, so what part of Andalusia were you in?
So I was just north of Seville.
Right.
About an hour north of Seville, and in a village called Casaya de la Sierra.
Okay.
And I was sort of going around the Sierra Morena Mountains helping out, working for a small kind of ranch there.
Just quickly, last question, then we get back to the book. But you're obviously quite a handy horse person, but then you get to hang out with the Mongolians, and presumably you must have felt like a somebody on the stabilizer stabilizers on their bike doing the Tour de France.
Yeah, well, having said that, there are things, I mean, I do mock the UK, but there are things that we kind of know a lot about that they might not. Do you know what I mean? So we did actually share a lot of ideas there, which was cool.
All right.
However, their horsemanship, perhaps, or their seeing horses in a more spiritual way was something that I definitely needed to learn more about.
So, Sasha, your horse for this trip. This is one. Obviously, this is a horse that you've known before, that you bring over. I mean, you don't just saddle up and go, do you?
No, definitely not. I think, I mean, it came about, because obviously I thought it'd be better to get a horse in the country I'm starting from than, you know, do the ridiculous thing of kind of boxing it over or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I was working for a stud farm down in Naples, and I was working for free for 4 months with the idea that eventually there was going to be a gelding that was going to be lent to me as a thanks for all the work. And then anyway, it got to about 3 weeks before I was meant to leave, and unfortunately that was all a lie, and I'd basically been completely mugged off. And I then had to I got a hire car and went around Italy just trying to find any loose connection of anyone who knew anything about horses, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, got to the north of Italy and was recommended this amazing stud called Bozzana that do Arabs. And I got there, rode one horse called Sasha, and he was completely, well, fairly uncontrollable, very spirited, young, and kind of refused to go in a circle. And I thought this guy would be perfect for going west. And 5 days later, we started.
Why did you think he would be perfect for going west if he's uncontrollable and you've got to go over the you know, uncharted land with wolves and snow-capped mantis? I thought you want something a bit more docile.
They become docile. I think what you what you kind of don't want is something that is already, before you even begin, got its own stubbornness. I think if you've got something that's slightly blindly brave, as it were, then you can kind of temper it. And sure enough, he became very wise to the ways. But at first, you kind of want something that's just going to go. And because a lot of horses don't. So I was very lucky with him because he was that bit kind of green, as they say. And just a spirited gelding. So it worked out well. And sure enough, you know, because you're taking an Arab one day, once upon a time, what belonged in the sands, and then you're putting in the Ligurian Alps. If he doesn't have that kind of bravery about him, then yeah, he certainly will feel a long way from home.
So how do the mechanics of it work then? I mean, presumably you've got a route planned out, you've got somewhere to stay, are you bivouacking? You know, you're not trotting down the side of the auto, or, you know, the autopista.
No.
So how did it actually work? And did you have somewhere to stay every night or every couple of nights? Because you know, you've got to feed and water your horse as well.
Yeah. I mean, the enormity of the distance is something that I had to sort of cut up into pieces. You know, it was almost 2,000 miles and took 111 days. So I kind of sectioned it up into each country. The Via Francigena was a route that I began with from Siena up into the Alps. And then suddenly, as I said, the Alps were a bit of a grey zone. When I got there, I'd actually made contact with these two ladies who were local in the area, who were trekkers, and they knew a lot about horses through Facebook. And I asked, do you know any routes that go across the Ligurian Alps? And basically, together for 4 or 5 days, I stayed in their little mountain house, and we plotted a route that might work using old partisan trails and Second World War routes and local routes and stuff like that. So and we put it together, and I used an app, and I put it on my phone, and slowly, day by day, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. However, it was pretty concrete, and we got to the end of the Ligurian Alps, and suddenly you're in France. We used a mixture of GR trails. And then as soon as we got to Arles, we used the Camino de Santiago de Compostela, which basically we kind of followed on and off until we got to Finisterre.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, I mean, one of the things I love about this is that you're, because you want, if you're like, you're taking this route that is taking you past some really important, like Arles, places that perhaps, you know, in the Carpathian kings of France and whatever, these were important towns, and they've sort of been forgotten, but there are still on routes that are pretty much in touch. So it's not just a journey, without getting all mystic on you, it's not just a journey geographically, but you are almost operating a time machine, because these are the routes that would have been taken to places like Arles, you know, in the what we call the Middle Ages.
Absolutely. And then also the way that you start seeing the landscape itself through the eyes of the horse and through the tracks that once upon a time were just made for horses is an extraordinary way to see the world, and it's very revealing in a way. As you say, places like Arles, but also in the Ligurian Alps, we were literally going over these routes that were used by the partisans, and then even stayed in a stable that was built by Napoleon in 1782, and it's still standing, and that's where Sasha slept, and yeah, very extraordinary history you're conjuring up every day.
I'm just thinking about, you must be thinking, hang on a second, this is hard enough, Hannibal got a couple of elephants through here.
Yeah, exactly. I know, he was, believe it or not, his route and Napoleon's route were the two routes that I actually considered starting off. However, we made our own, luckily, so it was all good.
Now, when you go on this route as well, because you are interested in folklore as well, I don't mean, you know, putting Morris dancing hat on, but there's that connection, isn't there? And you know, the community, you know, Santiago, you know, the Camino is well known, but also, you know, there are, because we tend to think that as quote unquote Europeans, we watch the TV, same TV shows, we all dress the same, we all eat the same fast food or whatever. But with a route like this and a journey like this, you get to look at the various, you know, the various customs and the various traditions that are still, when you get off the main road, that are still very much in evidence.
Yeah, exactly. And you see them in their regions, you see them in their counties, you see them in their once upon a time kingdoms. You know, going through the Camargue is extraordinarily different to going through the Basque country, which is obviously a very, very strong culture, as it is going through, you know, north of Spain or Galicia, and then, you know, contrast that with Liguria. You know, it's a wonderful pace. It's a natural pace, you know, to walk anyway, as we all know, as a human. But, you know, with a horse, you have that little bit extra of speed, so you never go fast enough to lose anything, but never linger long enough for it to become, you know, normal, and it's just a wonderful it's a wonderful conjuring or going through history as you move and really appreciating the places, the changing in architecture day by day, you know, and slowly from one region to the other, it kind of makes sense that now it's different here because you've kind of seen landscape and buildings slowly move into another style, depending on where you are. And you're literally stepping through history back and forth. It's pretty special.
And also, you know, in a world where we're all having arguments about the color of our socks on social media and a route like this, you know, just goes to show that actually, you know, if you're nice and considerate to people, they will be nice and considerate back to you. You always find on the road.
100%. I think that's the best observation, because it's there's one thing that I kept on thinking was just how, you know, it's if someone said to me, oh yeah, we've got some water, or we've got there's a field I know of where your horse can. That for me, that was everything. And then they might say, if you're lucky, oh yeah, yeah, and come and we've got a bed as well if you want to stay inside, or here's a glass of wine, or whatever. Or we've actually got a shower. You know, suddenly with so little, you become so full. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the biggest lessons was the fact that, as you're describing, you know, socks and whatnot. It's choice that takes away from all these intricate natural things that are actually so so pleasing, and it's just simple kindness from strangers, simple human interaction, sharing a story, and literally having a roof over your head that suddenly becomes the center of your world. And that I was extremely grateful for. Yeah.
A very good friend of mine, at least recently did the whole of the Camino Santiago from the Pyrenees through to where you ended up in Finestre. And he did it on foot, and he actually sort of like 3 days out of from Santiago, he took a left because he didn't want to get, you know, because there are the weekenders who sort of do the last gasp, it were. But he describes literally going through Galicia with the sun coming up over the mists and it being, you know, the spiritual experience. And I'm not saying that you're now floating on a magic carpet somewhere in Bath, but what I'm saying, you know, do you find that sort of journey sort of changes the and Galicia wow, and also, you know, Finestre wow times 100?
Yeah, I think as Paul Theroux, a travel writer, once said, when you go that far away, you never really come all the way back. And it's certainly, I mean, it's the reason it's the reason I did this one in the first place, was because after the UK ride, getting down to Land's End, I thought this can't end, you know, I want this to go on. And then sure enough, reaching another Land's End in Finisterre, I was like, well, this can't end either. And I'm obviously now planning the next one. But it's certainly at the time is a world of its own, and it creates something very magical. What's difficult is coming back to, you know, a reality that's very different to that, and trying to maintain that magic somehow that's the challenge, I think.
Yeah. What was it? When you go so far away, you never really come back. What was it you said? I love that. What's that?
Yeah, well, it's a Paul Theroux quote. Yeah. If you go that far away, you never truly come back.
Right.
All the way back.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to use that one as well. So when it do come to the end and you, was there sort of, I mean, did you throw yourself in the Atlantic? Because that was the end of the world, wasn't it, to the ancients? That was, you could go no further, and from that point, there be dragons.
Yeah, exactly. And that was a very cool thing to try and imagine. But sure enough, once you're there, the Cape Finisterre itself, it's a rocky kind of headland, and then that's it. It's a sort of precipice down. And so we couldn't sort of jump in, as it were. We stopped and saw the sun go down, which was very beautiful and sad, to be honest. And then made our way back in town for some wine. And then we kind of thought, what the hell do we do now? And it was a strange, by that time, a young woman from the Netherlands had joined me, having lost her sister to suicide, very sadly. And she had met me, heard about my journey and met me, and we'd end up traveling together for 80 days. And so we had become sort of a partnership by that point. So luckily it wasn't just me and Sasha, it was me, her horse and Sasha. And then, yeah, we kind of worked out what we were going to do. Eventually, we found one of the lovely farmers shepherds that we'd stayed in going over the Pyrenees. He sent her a text, saying, if you are looking for a place for your horses, which I probably imagine you are, they can stay in the hill, the mountains with mine. So we managed to get them across, asking some favors from people to, you know, transport them over slowly to the Pyrenees, and they stayed there for for 6 months, and I lived with the shepherd for a while to make sure our horses were okay there, and then I went back to Scotland and then sort of came back a bit later to see them again, and now those two horses are in Scotland, working as the horses for the Bicouf.
Wow. Amazing, because that was going to be my next question. You know, what happens to the, you know, what happens to the horse? When it comes to writing, this is an amazing story. When it comes to writing this, I mean, did you keep a journal whilst you were going, or have you got, you know, because I doubt that you were sort of Instagramming on the way through, because that was defeat the purpose. So, how, you know, what's it like to revisit it when after you've sort of sat down, as it were?
Yeah, absolutely. It would have defeated the purpose. I have a really bad memory, short-term memory. So I had a diary. I made sure to just write everything down every single day. It wasn't the overall intention at all to write a book at the end of it. I just knew that I should just write it down, because I might not be able to do anything like this again. So anyway, by the end of it, I had some 5 books of diaries. Got back to the UK eventually after settling the horses, and a publisher reached out to me saying she'd heard about the book. I heard about the journey, through a newspaper, and she said, "Have you ever considered writing something about it?" And I wasn't, you know, a straightforward yes, to be honest, because I was so, you do such a thing like that, which requires or creates so much adrenaline. As soon as you come back, you don't really know what was it all for? What the hell was I doing? What was I searching for? Why did I even begin it? Who cares? And all these kind of very self-doubting, self-loathing questions come into your head, I think. And, well, they did for me. However, she just said, just simply transcribe your diaries onto a laptop or a computer, whatever. Let's just see what we've got. So I did that, and then she read it, and then she basically said, this is what I think. There might be something here or here. What do you think? And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll try again. And eventually we sort of, you know, etched it away like a sculpture, and then brought these themes to life. And suddenly, before I knew, I realized I was looking at a quite an intense love story, you know, with these two horses leading the way. And I hadn't really admitted it to myself that was the case. And it was a very strange, therapeutic kind of year that followed, which was that editing process.
What are you hoping that people are going to take from In Green?
Good question. I think that's something, there's a lot to do, there's a lot with serendipity. I think that serendipity is still alive. I think stepping into the unknown is something that we kind of banish as a Western society, or the uncontrollables we don't like. I think having faith in that unknown, having faith in the uncontrollable, because that brings out things that obviously are spontaneous and you don't expect, but also it brings out things inside yourself, which I think we don't allow, I guess, the light of day, just because we are so catered for and, you know, so manicured. And it brought me so much happiness. I have to say, I was the happiest I've ever been in my life. And it was a real adventure. And I think that's something that's so hard to come by. And travel is something that's almost becoming a touristic commodity. But real travel is unplanned. It's full of adventures and mistakes and random people. And I think that's something that I would hope everyone, in their small or big way, whatever it is, goes maybe without their phone and just has an unfiltered, raw experience that is, I think, is so important for us. I hope that might inspire that, I guess.
Absolutely. If people want to find, we talked about this, the social media thing, but are you on the social? Can people follow you online? Where can they find?
Yes. Yeah. Well, the Big Hoof, being a mental health charity, we're very much have a social media presence and so with the Big Hoof on Instagram and our website, and then I've got one for the purpose basically of trying to sell my book, which is Louis D. Hall, Hall,
and you'll be able to listeners, you can order the book via our own virtual bookstore. I'm gonna run out of time, but this book is called In Green: Two Horses, Two Strangers, and a Journey to the End of the Land. Listeners, go and get it, go and order it via our own virtual bookstore. Louis D. Hall, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, at all. It's been really a real pleasure. Thank you so much. And I hope all the listeners enjoy their day and have a little adventure wherever that may be.